welcomes you to our second session in the Family Economics Working Well in the New Economy track. Our interest in the Economic Opportunities Program is really in strategies to help people who are struggling in today's economy better connect to jobs and opportunity to improve their financial situation. And we really focus on how that's done, but we have, with the generous support of the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the Casey Family Program, we're able to put together this track to explore some of the main issues that shape opportunities for people to better succeed in today's economy. So I'm delighted to be able to introduce this morning our two guest speakers. We have with us today Manuel Pastor. I'll read my little note here. He's a professor of Latin American and Latino Studies and co-director of the Center for Justice, Tolerance, and Community at University of California at Santa Cruz. And he is also the author of the book from which we stole the session title, Searching for the Uncommon Common Ground, and has also authored a number of other articles on this subject, some of which are on your chair. And we also have with us John Powell, and John is the director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State within the Morris College of Law. Right. You can correct me if I get this wrong.
It's university-wide.
Okay. Oh, it's university-wide. I'm sorry. And he is an internationally recognized expert in the issues of civil rights, civil liberties, poverty, and the law. And we're delighted to have him with us here this morning as well. And so without further ado, I'll turn it over to Manuel to kick off the discussion. And the format we're going to have this morning, just so you know, is that each of them are going to present for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open it up for a conversation, and we hope to really engage you in that discussion.
Thanks. Thanks for the introduction. We have a few enough people here that it might be good just to hear who you are, maybe your name and your organization. You can even say why you showed up this morning.
I'm Catherine Clough, and I'm a fan of John Powell's. I've heard him speak before, and I'm sure I'll be a fan of yours soon.
I'm a fan of John Powell's, too. That's why I decided to come.
I'm Betsy Hamilton. I came because I'm married to this man. I work in public education in California.
I should note that I'm a fan of Betsy Hamilton's, too. So.
I'm Andrew Ryan Thomas, and I'm also at the Kerwin Institute with John Powell.
I'm Adrian Hahn with Casey Family Programs, and
I'm Antoinette Nalboe, Casey Family Programs, and
I'm Robert Foster with Kellogg Foundation. I follow both of these gentlemen's work quite seriously for the physical work we do.
It's back here.
I'm Ed Hatcher with the Hatcher Group.
I'm Janet Topolsky with the Aspen Institute, the Community Strategies Group.
Very good. We're introducing ourselves so that we know who's in the room.
I'm Nancy Lovell. I'm an attendee.
I'm Angela Stanford, and I'm staff. I'm here to help out.
Sounds good.
I'm Cynthia Maria, and I'm also staff.
And I'm here because I'm from Argentina, so I thought it would be interesting.
That sounds good. And we'll talk about the Argentine peso crisis as well. So you'll feel right at home. La caída de Argentina, right?
Yes. Hi, I'm Tina Walls, and I work for Philip Morris. I'm head of our philanthropic and community involvement efforts. And we are now based in Richmond, Virginia. So these are big issues for us.
I'm Paul Alston. I'm a lawyer in Hawaii. And I'm interested because in Hawaii we deal with interracial problems all the time, seem to do it more successfully than people in the mainland. And I want to hear why.
I think it's the weather, but.
I'm Judy Samuelson, also with the Aspen Institute, the Business and Society Group.
Great, very good.
I'm Beth Smith, University of Missouri, Kansas City, nonprofit leadership, and sometimes I teach a multicultural course.
Great. And right up here?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jeannie Mulgrave. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Youth and Community Development in New York City.
Great.
I'm Dorothy Stillman. I'm head of Youth Build USA, which involves low-income young people who've dropped out of school across the country and building housing for low-income people. So I have an abiding interest in building common ground and in eliminating poverty.
Kristen Wolf, I'm with the Economic Outreach Program at the Aspen Institute.
And before coming back here?
I'm Gwen Robbins, I'm with GE Consumer Finance.
Nancy Cohen, attendee.
And showing that our group is ever flexible, we actually have an additional person who will be speaking this morning, I think, too. So,
I'm T.D. Jakes. I'm with the Potter's House Ministry and a part of the rebuilding of the Gulf area throughout New Orleans.
Great. Okay, well, I've been asked to kick this off, and I'm actually going to take the liberty of doing a bit of PowerPoint with just some information to kind of get us started. I realize that doing PowerPoint is incredibly dangerous now after an inconvenient truth because the standards have been set so high. I'm sure this won't be filmed. I do want to mention that aside from the book that Searching for the Uncommon, Common Ground, that John and I are planning on writing a book on this. And I don't think we have a title yet, but we have negotiated the movie rights. So you'll be able to see it eventually. I'll be played by Antonio Banderas, which I'm really excited about. And John and John actually played by Denzel Washington, which will be quite a draw, I think, for people. Totally. You know, we know how to market. I want to start by basically saying that we understand that race is a very difficult topic for people in America to speak about. And it's a very difficult topic. People are afraid that they might be politically incorrect for saying certain kinds of things. We know when we have these conversations that whites often feel like either they might be under attack or if they're of very good will, they might just clumsily say something that'll be misinterpreted. People of color feel discomfort because they don't want to be seen through the prism of just their race or ethnicity and not really who they are. And so these are very difficult conversations for people to have. And partly for that reason, we tend often to go for the lowest common denominator. We either go for the lowest common denominator in terms of putting one group and pitting it against another, we've heard about that a lot, or we go for the lowest common denominator in terms of agreement, right? Like, we're against, cross-burning in front of people's homes, right? And we go for the lowest common denominator about our agreement that everyone needs education and that prejudice is bad. And actually, this book that we wrote, the co-authors, Angela Glover Blackwood Stewart, and Cole and I have often said about this book, we're not sure how good the book is, but the title is great. Because searching for the uncommon common ground means not going for the lowest common denominator, but trying to find the highest common ground on which you can agree. And that means putting forward conflict and difference and trying to find out in hard conversation. And so we hope that we set a tone of being able to talk about uncomfortable things in a challenging way. I want to try to make a few quick points. Which are three, really. So I'll say them now, and then some of the family members who are here were saying that they would probably read during the presentation so they can just tune back later. But that about the rapidity of change that's occurring in the United States and what dislocation that's producing, about the paradox of progress, which is that we've made a lot of progress on some things, but we've made very little progress on differences in terms of economic outcomes and some other measures. And then finally, the sort of changing terrain of issues that we need to work on. They're not the old civil rights issues. The new civil rights issues often have to do with urban sprawl, the criminal justice system, and other sorts of things. So this first chart is really just the changing American demographics between 1970 and 1980. And you can see there's been a relatively big shift. The darkest group here is the non-Latino white, non-Hispanic white, and it's been in steady decline. The steady growth has been happening in the Latino population in the United States as a share. Now, the United States, though, is poised to go through dramatic demographic change in the next 50 years. The projections show that we're going to go from being a society that's about 71% white, non-Hispanic white. We say Anglo in California. Welcome to the term. Yet you're going to see that as you move to the year 2050, we're going to be, as a U.S. society, pretty much a majority or very nearly a majority minority society. And so that's a very big change that's going to happen over the next 50 years. And what's interesting is that that change that's happened between, that is projected to happen between 2000 and the year 2050 is exactly the demographic change that occurred in California between the years 1980 and 2000. So in that sort of compressed time period in California, we helped show the nation the rest of their future. And as you know, that was a harmonious time for racial relations in California. We had the most massive civil unrest in U.S. history. We had tremendous tensions around immigration, particularly undocumented immigration. And so it's sort of no surprise that it's popping back up, I think, in the nation as a whole. And we also saw tremendous change in terms of African-American Latino relationships with proximity in the central cities of California. So we've seen a lot of change in California that suggests that there may be some difficult days ahead and hope, of course, that people learn to do things a bit differently than we. I think another thing that's probably in the future of the rest of the United States will be the recall of the president and the election or putting in place instead of a major motion picture hero, perhaps Tom Cruise. So California has had a quite bumpy ride around racial relations. And one of the things to think about as we project forward for all of the United States is to understand that the future is now. That is, when you look forward and you project this demographic change, what people don't realize, and you can see it most dramatically in the case of California again, is the difference between the demographics of the old and the demographics of the young. For those who are 65 years or older, pretty reliable voters, 71% white in the state of California. For those who are 40 to 64, again, pretty reliable voters, high income, higher income in terms of their life cycles and taxpayers, about 58% white. And that group is making decisions for a new generation that is two-thirds kids of color. That is what I think of as California's generation gap. It's a generation gap in terms of the demographic divergence between the old and the young and the issues it raises in terms of the willingness to invest, frankly, in the young. We did a study for the Public Policy Institute of California. I'll apologize, by the way, if I'm speaking fast. I would be speaking faster if I was speaking in Spanish, but I think mostly he would understand. We did a study for the Public Policy Institute of California trying to take a look at what happens when there's demographic divergence between the old and the young. And we found out that the larger the demographic divergence between the old and the young, the lower the level of state infrastructure spending, infrastructure meaning building for the future. We cannot repair this by changing the demographics. We have to repair this by weaving the generations together in a common narrative of hope for America. So there's been very rapid change. Part of that rapid change, of course, is the increase in immigration. This gives you a long-term view of the percent of the U.S. population that was foreign-born. You can see that the peaks, of course, were at the earlier turn of the century, and that we became increasingly a non-immigrant or native-born country until 1970. The 1965 civil rights laws and movements led to an immigration reform that opened up the doors to other countries. And so we became far more immigrant as time has gone on. And we've seen, even in that short period of time between 1970 and 2000, a very dramatic change in who the immigrants are. In 1970, about 72% of the foreign-born residents in the United States were from European countries. In the year 2000, about 70% of the foreign-born residents are from Latin America or Africa or Asia. So tremendous change in the demographics of the immigrants.
Is that legal immigrants?
This is the census, and the census undercounts undocumented, but less than you'd think. So this is including the undocumented residents, and at least to some degree. So there's been very dramatic change, and this dramatic change is leading to, I think, discomfort and disconnection. And we need to acknowledge that. One of the things that we don't do well when we talk about race in America is acknowledge the discomfort that's there in the room when people talk. Let me give you an example about the immigration debate, which is I had a very civil tone, of course, over the last few months. It's been really a not civil tone, and it's been very emotional. We need to realize the emotion is there and that it's real. You know, I like to say that my dad came to the United States in the 1930s with papers that were not perfect, and he stayed, right? In World War II, he was given the choice between being deported and joining the U.S. Army. He couldn't decide what to do. He gave a coin to my cousin Carlitos, who flipped it. He put the penny in his pocket, went to the war, and came back, and he was a citizen. So when I hear people say stuff about undocumented, my gosh, you know, I got skin in that game, right? My emotions go up, and we need to realize that people's emotions go up around the immigration debate. And for those who are discomforted about immigration, they see a world that they understood being taken from them. They see what they perceive of as a changing, you know, I mean, we think of it in California, like, you know, my God, California is becoming more immigrant. You know, and of course, those of us on the other side like me go, yeah, the city of Los Angeles, yeah. You know, but just the same, there's a discomfort about that, right? There's a discomfort for many in the African-American community who see changing neighborhoods and a dilution of political power. And unless we acknowledge the pain and discomfort, we can't have an honest conversation. So tremendous change and some pain that occurs as a result. How am I on time? Okay. So now, the paradox of progress. There has been actually tremendous progress in terms of attitudes. And this is a question from the Gallup poll about whether or not you would accept an African-American president. You can see, as a matter of fact, that it's become almost 95% of people say that they would accept an African-American president. And, of course, we actually already had one, because those of you who follow the Program 24, know that David Palmer is who you would actually like to have in office, right? Tremendous calm and stuff. So there's been a tremendous change in attitudes, although there probably hasn't been as much change in attitudes as we would like. There was a recent study done by a professor at Oregon State University who did a very interesting thing where he sent out emails to landlords looking for housing in Southern California. And he sent them out with three names, identical emails: Patrick McDonough, Tyrell Washington, or Saeed Al-Ramad. He believed, who did you think he believed would get the least number of responses? Saeed, right? Who do you think got the least number of responses? Tyrell, right? So, and both faced discrimination on a pure kind of housing market search. So there are many who think discrimination no longer exists, and certainly good tests and evidence that it does. But perhaps the most significant thing is not so much people's attitudes and direct discrimination.
Does that chart suggest that in the 60s that there were more people who would accept an African-American president than who wouldn't?
In responding to a question, right, which does not mean that they would really accept it. It just means that when they were asked the question, they said, oh, I will accept it. According to the Gallup poll.
You know, because they do this kind of polling for women, mm-hmm. except a qualified woman. You know, and what they know now is that that question is at less indicative than the question, do you think your neighbor would vote for a qualified woman?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the number goes from 93% yes to about 55% yes. And the pollsters actually believe that that's actually the more accurate, because no one is actually going to tell someone.
But attitudes have changed. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that attitudes have changed tremendously in terms of the level of acceptance. Segregation in major metropolitan areas between blacks and whites has declined. That's also an important change. But there's been very little change in terms of the difference between white and, on the top actually here, Asian household income, and the gaps between that and black and Latino income. Part of that, the reasons for that have to do with a failed educational structure and the kind of concentration of ethnic minorities in particular neighborhoods. Part of it has to do with changing family structure, which I'm sure that the bishop might say a bit about as well. And part of it has to do with sort of our failure in terms of public policy. I'm going to be respectful of time and jump ahead to the last slides. The ones that you're going to miss are actually really tremendous, so you should feel pretty much a great loss as I come to a close. Let me just jump past these, which are more data, and I can make those available to folks. And let me talk a little bit about how I think we might think about our conversation.
And I don't mean just the conversation in this room, but the conversation about race in America. I guess I would suggest that we need to understand the pain and emotion in these topics. We try to deal with them rationally, but I think some of the feelings aren't rational, and they come from deep places in our experience. They come from the places where people know what it is to be brown or black while driving, and understand that when someone says that doesn't happen, that it does. And that I did an interesting thing with the police officers where police officers of color actually finally convinced their white colleagues it was going on because they'd been pulled over in other jurisdictions, right? So we need to understand there's pain and emotion on all sides of this and acknowledge that. We need to celebrate the progress that's been made. I think one of the things that those of us who care about race do is say, you know, man, the economics are bad, the kids are still poor, the schools are crappy, and people then go, geez, you can't really do anything about it. The way I think about it, given my side of the political spectrum, is you need to put the progress back in progressive. You need to give people an idea that there's hope and vision and resilience ahead. I want to say just two other things. But I'm going to give you like a little image of resilience because, you know, in the midst of this great kind of immigration debate and the sense that America's being lost and stuff, actually, kind of freaks me out because I think America's so resilient and so much a dream for people who come here. We had a wonderful experience the other night where two friends of ours, Kent Wong, Chinese-American, and Jay Lee Wong, Korean-American, both turned 50, so they decided to celebrate their 100th birthday. And we had a great dinner, and then we all went to a karaoke bar together, right? And it was a group that was African-American and Latino and white and Asian. And at one point, Jose Luis, a young man, got up with a young Chinese woman who was singing with a Chinese accent, and they were singing Summer Nights from Greece, right, on the karaoke machine, right? And the people who sort of worry that this changing diversity is going to lead to a loss of who we are, they have less faith in America than do the immigrants who are waving those flags and understand that the promise and hope and the resilience of U.S. culture is there and that it's something that we can really pull on. So I think we really need to do that. And the only other point I'll make to close is that we need to understand we have a kind of romantic vision of the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King gave a speech. Everyone went, my God, what we were thinking, right? And they learned to collaborate, right? It was a hard road. I'm 50 myself, and I came up on the tail end of some of that. I know how hard it was and how much harder it was for those who were older than me. I know how much conflict there was and how much integrity there was in that conflict. And if we want to move ahead, we have to take the happy face away from collaboration and understand that there'll be conflict and differences of opinion as we strive for consensus and higher common ground. So thank you, and I think it's John.
Yes. So you actually have more children who are African-American and something else. So is that one of the how are you counting those kids? Because I know that's one of the big issues with the U.S. Census in terms of, they're saying we want to be counted as other, and then at the same time we have, I think back to Louisiana, where my grandmother was from, was like if you're 1 ounce or 1/32 seconds, you're African-American. So how are we counting these children?
I think John is really going to talk about that. Let me just say one word that really resonates. I mean, I think that our categories are no longer very good. John will talk more about it. My wife and I, when we had kids at 19 and 17 years ago, and we went to the Lamaze classes, there was and these were in Los Angeles, there was not a single couple that was of the same ethnicity, right? So that, I mean, it may have been just our classes or something, but there is a really tremendous change going on that way. There's a kind of way in which culture is still being hung on to, but it's also changing and transforming. And I think, John, that was your first point, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm going to make a number of points, and I have some handouts. If you didn't get the handouts and you want them, just let me know. And also, if there's not enough, I have websites where you can download all of the handouts. I'm going to make three points. One of them teeing on the question, is that the changing demographics, I think we sort of misunderstand the implications of the changing demographics. And part of the reason is that the categories themselves change and the meaning of the categories change. So I'll talk a little bit about that. I'll also talk a little bit about the way we sort of think about race in the United States and largely think about race versus class and what's wrong with that approach. And then finally, I'll talk about what I call a transformative discourse and practice around race. So those are the three main areas I'll talk about. Let me start with the categories. You've seen the data that Manuel shared with you. I want to sort of take us back a little bit, and this is in one of the pieces that you have. First of all, I'll just ask the question. All of us know, most of us know the case Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the case that ushered in formalized Jim Crow on railroad cars. What was Homer Plessy? Other than my daughter. Close. Anyone?
Wasn't he a runaway son?
No. Okay, Sunita?
He was an octoroon.
And what is an octoroon?
He was 1/8.
1/8 white. And he was phenotypically white. And in fact, one of the things he argued in the case is that the law was unconstitutional because it took away his interest in whiteness. That whiteness was of material value, and by categorizing him as a non-white, he lost something. That's important. If we sort of go back historically, in every census, the way the United States has counted different racial ethnic groups has changed. It has never been stable. There's a time, for example, when Mexican Americans were counted as whites, not whites with a Latino surname, just whites, and then times where it flipped. There's nothing to suggest that that practice of how we do categories around race everything suggests that will continue to change. So how we think about race, who is white, who is non-white, who is Latino, who's black, who's what it means, all of that will change. What that suggests is that we can take the numbers and project them out 50 years, but we don't know what the numbers mean. We don't know who will be counted as white. We don't know what white will mean. We don't know who will be counted as black. We don't know what black means. We don't know what multiracial mean, a new category. What does it mean? And so it's not simply categorizing people to label them right. We have to think about the meaning of these categories and the work that they do. And there's a lot of suggestions out there, and one of the pieces I gave you by Ian Haney-Lopez talks about really five different models of race in the future. One is what he calls white exceptionalism. That is, you have all these people of different races, and then you have whites. And so it's either white or non-white. And some people argue that that's the paradigm that was founded the country. You're white, which meant you were a full member or had the possibility to be a full member, or you're non-white, which meant you weren't a full member. And that's what the Civil War was fought over. That's what Dred Scott was about, is can you be a member of this polity? And the court in Dred Scott said only if you're white. And there's a famous case, the Teton case, where an Asian Indian who had lived in the United States for 25 years, had children, became once naturalized in the 1920s. At the time, you could only become a naturalized citizen of the United States if you were white. And so he said, I am white. I'm actually a Caucasoid. I'm Aryan. And they said, well, you may be white based on some metrics, but that you're not the kind of white person we're talking about. So you cannot naturalize. He committed suicide. And so part of the thing that I want to suggest, and I've given you a handout, is that when we talk about race, most of the time in America, when we talk about race, we think about it in terms of that's about non-whites. That's about blacks, Latinos, Asians, maybe Native Americans. White people generally don't think of themselves in racial terms. What I want to suggest is that the category that in some way historically has been most destructive in terms of promoting the kind of society that we now aspire to is the category of whiteness itself. The piece that I've given you, a short piece, which I describe as white space, the space that is exclusive, the space that is based on fear, the space that's based on othering everyone else. And Now, the challenge is this, and I think this space is very destructive, not just to people who are outside the space, but to people who are inside the space. And so part of the thing I think that's called for in terms of a new way of thinking about race is to disrupt the white space. Right now, a lot of strategies are really about making the white space more elastic. So you want to be a citizen? I'll be white. Whatever it takes to get all the goods in society, I'll be, instead of saying we shouldn't be basing these goods on race at all. We should sort of disturb these spaces. So these five models, one is white dominance, where the space remains salient. Another model is black exceptionalism, which is that basically everybody is okay except for blacks. And we already see some indication that that's the case. Now, let me be clear. When I say black, I don't mean people who are biologically black, whatever that means. Black is a political space. So some people who might now be considered black will no longer be considered black. But according to Yancey and others, there'll be a category, a hard category, where if you're in that category, you're the designated other. And if you think about stuff around prisons and the example that Manuel just gave in terms of housing, it's like we may not like someone with this name that sounds like a name from the Middle East, but a black name, now that's really scary. So that's the black exceptionalism. Another model is what is called the Latinization of race, where race becomes somewhat fluid, but it's still a hierarchy. And I did some work in Brazil, which is coins itself as a racial democracy. I call Brazil a pigmentocracy because color is extremely important in terms of Brazil. There are many different categories. It's very fluid. But at the end of the day, it's the light-skinned people who are the most valued and the dark-skinned people who are the most devalued. And they say in Brazil that money whitens. Well, the idea is that if you have money, something good happens to you. You become lighter. And that's sort of, you know, it may be an improvement over the model we have today, but it's not where we want to be. The fourth model is a multicultural model, which is where race actually loses salience in terms of distributing outcomes, benefits. And it's a model, I would say, that Canada is struggling with in a much more robust way than we are. We are still hiding from race, and so we sort of want to get it behind us. We sort of want to sort of talk about assimilation, which is very problematic. I won't say much more about that right now. And then the fifth model that Ian talks about, which he calls white dominance colorblindness, where you still have whites dominating, not superiority, not based on white supremacy, but white dominance. And the ideology of it that supports it is colorblindness. Now, the reason that that's important, and Ian argues that that's where we're most likely to go, is that we justify these demographics, some of which Manuel showed us, by a claim of colorblindness. We're not seeing color. And then we say, how are our schools segregated? How are our housing segregated? How are our prison systems segregated? And we explain this all in terms of without reference to race at all. And one question is, well, how do we sort people in these racialized ways without reference to race? And largely we do it through a number of things, but one of them is space, and the other is institutional arrangements. I mean, think of how we fund schools. You know, we put all poor people, especially all poor people of color, in one place, and then we say, you fund your own schools. Can't fund schools? That's too bad. You got crappy schools? You're not as smart as the rest of us because we got good schools. It has nothing to do with race. It just so happens that all the poor schools underfunded are black and Latino in urban areas. And so we let these institutions and structures do the work, and we actually call this structural racism. And so we have this whole explanation as to some people live in a bad neighborhood. Can you imagine my family coming from the South, and they're saying, tell us where the bad neighborhood is. That's where we want to go. I mean, you know, no one would make that choice except we sort people through a whole series of mechanisms, many of which look race neutral on their face, but it has a predictable outcome that will isolate people of color. New Orleans is a wonderful and disturbing example. So why is it that all the poor people, all the black people that were left behind without cars, why is it that the Ninth Ward and some others, but the Ninth Ward was built next, right next to the water below sea level? Why is it that, and you know, and so we have, and we're trying to make sense of this given the fact that we're now supposedly in this colorblind society. So that's sort of the potential future. All of those possibilities out there, which of those possibilities occur, depend largely on what we do. Let me say something very quick about race and class. In the United States, particularly because discussions of race are so poignant and so hard, the classical move is, it has nothing to do with race, it's all about class. Interesting question. How is it that all the black folks, all the Latinos, got to be at the lower end of the class stick? Right? And actually, we know. I mean, the history on it is very clear. Most Americans have generated their wealth, not income, through housing. The housing policy in the United States is radically segregated, is radically racialized. But we forget about that history and just say, it just has to do with money. My point is, and I've given you a piece on this, that race and class in the United States are extremely connected, have always been connected. So it's not one or the other. And I say there's only probably one thing in this country that we understand worse than race, and it's class. When we talk about class in the United States, we don't talk about it in the European sense of a group that has a class solidarity. We talk about middle class status. We talk about class in a very individualistic sense, just like we talk about race in an individualistic sense. So it actually obscures the conversation and helps us move away from that really hard conversation of race. So even in Croson, the affirmative action, the set-aside case, O'Connor, and many of you may have seen her, she was just here, said, you know what, we don't want you to look at race unless you first look at class, and you can't do all this work by doing it through class. A very unsophisticated analysis. I mean, so surprising coming from the Supreme Court. But it's something that it sort of feeds our colorblindness and sort of explains this. And I think that we have to have a much deeper and richer understanding of class. Let me say one other thing before I leave that. If we think about two things, I want to give you two examples. First of all, some people are disturbed in terms of our electoral system that we, on national elections, we vote for the president through the Electoral College. Again, how many people know why we have an Electoral College other than my daughter? Okay, I'll give you very quick, and this is in Our Constitution by Kilmer at Harvard. There were three main reasons, and it's explicit. It's nothing subtle. One was, so we're getting ready to form the country, and the South doesn't have the same proportion of free people that the North does. And so the South is saying, we're coming to union, but if we only count free people, we're going to be at a numerical disadvantage. And so if we count the slaves, we'll be much better off. But how do you count the slaves? The slaves can't actually vote. The Three-Fifths Clause was to give the South a boost in terms of the Electoral College and to create greater parity. To give you how significant this was, virtually the first 34 years of this new formed nation, 30 of those years, the president was elected from the South, almost always from Virginia. And almost none of those presidents would have won, including Jefferson, but for counting the slaves. So counting the slaves created a structure that formed the beginning of all of our systems, because that determined who was going to be on the court. You could not be a federally appointed person unless you supported slavery. So it distorted everything. And my point is not to dredge up some of our uncomfortable history. My point is that our institutional arrangement in the United States then and now were largely driven by concerns of race. The effect of that institutional arrangement has affected the entire country. The Electoral College doesn't just affect black people. It affects everyone. I'll give you one other example. The South started off supporting unions. Most people don't know that. People think the South and unions are anathema. They don't like the unions. In the 1930s, when Roosevelt pushed through the bills to strengthen unions, the South supported it. In 1947, the South withdrew its support because blacks were coming into the union, and we got the Taft-Hartley Act that destroyed unions in this country, and they have never recovered. Now, the destruction of unions in this country doesn't just affect black people. It affects the entire country. We have the weakest labor movement in the developed world, and it's because of race. The effect of that is that it depressed wages for all American workers, not just for black or Latino workers. So part of it is to understand that these racialized systems has a detrimental effect on the entire society. And we only understand that when we start looking at how race works and linking race and class. Okay, my last point, in terms of a transformative discussion about race. Manuel already touched on this. I want to say a couple of things. Usually when we think about race, we think about a problem. And we particularly think about a problem that's directed toward blacks and Latino. And we think about something that's hard, something that's negative. And we tell stories that reinforce that. So when we say, let's have a discussion about race, we talk about cross burnings, we talk about driving while black, we talk about breathing while brown, we talk about sitting while Asian. So the thing is that we tell these negative stories, which are real. They're real stories. But we don't tell the positive stories. We don't tell the fact that we just had the largest outpouring of public support in the history of the world, where whites were mainly sending money to try to help blacks after Katrina. It's an amazing thing. That wouldn't have happened. It didn't happen in the 1920 floods. You didn't have whites sending, on television, you can argue about it, but on television, the picture of the victims of the hurricane were black. And white Americans throughout the country open up their pocketbooks, some open up their homes to try to extend something to them. It doesn't mean we had a wonderful kumbaya yet, but it suggests that there really is some effort, some recognition by whites that wasn't there 30 or 40 years ago. We have a Supreme Court justice, African American, who was pushed by Southern senators who's involved in interracial relationship. We couldn't, can you imagine that in the 1950s? You couldn't imagine a black Supreme Court justice, let alone a black Supreme Court justice that's married to a white woman and being pushed by Southern senators. We have many examples of positive things, positive stories. And I think in some ways, in many cases, the positive outweigh the negative. But we don't tell the positive stories. And we don't talk about race in such a way that it links whites and non-whites. It's always one or the other. It's divisive. So when we talk about disparities, we talk about segregated opportunity in a field of declining opportunity. So let me give you a concrete example. In terms of health care, whites have about 70% of whites have adequate health care. About 40% of blacks have adequate health care, and about 42% of Latinos have adequate health care. In the discussion about health care and race, the discussion is almost always about closing that disparity. So if you're white and the whole discussion is about closing that disparity, what it means is that you're not going to get any more benefit. In fact, some of your benefits may have to be taken away. Okay. Some of your benefits may have to be taken away to close the disparity. But there's nothing positive in it for you except maybe a moral victory. And we work with Dayton, who's been working for 10 years to close the black-white disparity along a number of indicators. The good news is that the disparities have substantially closed. The bad news is not because blacks are doing any better, but because whites are doing worse. So we could have a different discussion about health care. We could talk about the disparities, but we could also talk about how do we get coverage so that everyone is covered. And so we're not talking about taking something away from the whites. We're talking about a society, a system, where everyone's lifted, and yet we still focus on those that are most marginal and in pain. So we need to have a transformative discussion about race. So let me just close by saying it's clear to me the way we do and think about race will radically change. It's not clear to me how it will change. What we do matters. And it requires a different way of thinking. And I'll just touch on the immigration issue. I don't have time to go into it in great detail. But what occurs to me is that if you look at globalization, if you look at what happened in Europe in the first iteration, right, is that we want to make capital free and more able to move. And in order to have structural parity, we need to do the same thing with labor. In the United States, when we entered the NAFTA bill, we said we want to make capital able to move more freely across the border, and we want to make sure labor does not move across the border. So the EU, 25 nations now, people can go across different borders, vote across different borders, go to school across different borders. The United States is talking about building a wall. So even our immigration discussion to me is sort of very old school. It's based on a 1890s model of the nation state. So I think that if we can celebrate, if we can deal with the hard issues, but deal with them in a celebratory way and sort of think about a future that we all want to live and all want our children to live in, we'll have a very different discussion. Thank you.
Thank you again, Bishop Dick, for joining our conversation this morning.
Okay. Thank you for having me. I don't have a question for John, but I do have a big amen for what he said. First, let me give a quick disclaimer that I'm the only speaker who didn't know he was going to speak until about 7:30 this morning. So weigh that into consideration as we... As I just shared briefly, some brief thoughts off the top of my head that I certainly agree with everything that has been said and been enlightened by some things that have been said. I think that this is an ongoing issue that continues to exist in our country, fed in part by two things of which we are equally uncomfortable with talking about, not only as it relates to race, but also as it relates to religion and politics. And from my perspective, I think that religion and politics contributes a lot to shaping the way we interact with each other, whether we consider ourselves to be religious or apolitical or partisan has little difference to do with the fact that religion historically has influenced art and writings, literature, music, the way we process morality, what we consider to be right and wrong is influenced directly by religion. Unfortunately, religion has done a terrible job with integration in this country and lags far behind the secular systems. So if we're having trouble in the secular front, I must tell you that in the church front, it is even worse. It is the elephant in the middle of the room that clergy do not talk about and they do not discuss. And so it becomes traumatic that what Dr. King said almost 50 years ago is still true today, that the 11 o'clock hour is still the most segregated hour in this country. And it points to something where we have to go to school in some cases together, and often we are forced to work together because we all need income. But when it comes to faith, we get to choose freely where we want to go, and when we're left to free will, we migrate back to our comfort zones. I think sometimes the very term racism itself undermines our ability to solve the issue because when we say racism, we think sheets and burning crosses, and then we immediately say, that's not me. But far deeper than that, there is an inbred racist mentality that exists in our behavior where we have certain cultural preferences that innately show up in our behavior. And that I personally think are somewhat natural. Some years ago, I was lost in a city and was in the mall trying to get directions. And there were a couple of people who walked past me that I really wanted to find out where to get, which way I needed to go. They were Caucasian people, and I just didn't ask them. And then a moment later, an old African-American man walked past, and I walked right up to him and asked him directions. When I got in the car, I asked myself, why didn't you ask the other people? Suddenly I begin to realize that there's a comfort zone issue. There's an innate comfort zone issue. And while that is a small, minute point, but it becomes a paramount point when you transfer those comfort zones into employment or healthcare or real estate or property, those comfort zone issues may not necessarily make you a racist with a sheet, But when it affects my economy and my well-being, then it has a devastation on me. And so those are some things that we really need to think about in this process. I was invited in to talk to a group of ministers, largely evangelical ministers, in the aftermath of the recent riots in Cincinnati. And the church was called in to assist Cincinnati in healing from the process, only to realize that the physicians needed healing themselves. And in a very frank and open conversation, and I do think that one of the things that is critical is to have a frank and open conversation, these ministers begin to talk to a group of African-American ministers to say that racism was not on their radar. And I responded, it's not on your radar because it doesn't directly affect you or your constituency. Not directly, but it does indirectly, because anytime you oppress any group of people, you are robbed of the contribution of what they bring to the table in terms of creativity, in terms of thought, in terms of cross-pollinization, and so forth and so on. That is to say, I personally think that we are better together than we are apart, and when one of us loses, we all lose. I want to say to you also that I think that solving these problems that exist are not going to happen organically. They have to happen intentionally. That you cannot stick your head in the sand like an ostrich and say, you know, over time this is just going to get better. Look at the stats; they're improving a little bit. This is going to go away. It will not go away organically. It has to be intentionally. As a clergyman, I pastored in West Virginia for years as an African American pastor, and pastored a church that ended up being 35% Caucasian. Where there is diversity in the church, it is generally with white leadership, which speaks to the fact that we are more comfortable with gathering together than we are with being led by somebody who looks differently from us. So when we begin to tackle this issue, it is not just what happens in the body of the problem. I would suggest to you it is what happens with the leadership of the issue. It is not the diversity in the workforce. It is the diversity of the management team and the CEOs and so forth and the decision makers. When we examine corporations, we ask them, how much diversity do you have in the corporation? We need to ask, how much diversity do you have in the leadership? Because until you have diversity on the head, you're not going to be able to affect change in the body, okay? And so that is something that we really have to go after. And in order to do that, we have to ensure that there is strong enough intellectual properties being disseminated amongst all cultures so that they have the wherewithal to be able to apply for top-level jobs. And when they do so, we must intentionally put them into positions so that we have a panoramic, holistic view of our culture as it changes. Now, we should do that. As a moralist, I would say we should do it because it's right. But as an economist, I would say we should do it because it's profitable. And I would say that we should do it because we're going to soon end up in a culture and a world that is far more integrated than it is now. And if we're going to be able to relate to our consumers and constituents, we have to have diversity in the leadership and in the process. When I came to Dallas, the demographics changed and began to include Spanish-speaking people, which was not so much an issue in West Virginia. Being sensitive to diversity, I decided that I was going to go into Spanish-speaking churches and just sit in the back to learn what it is like to be you. Because sometimes when we learn about each other from stats and from articles alone, we don't get a full perception of the touching and feeling of what makes people tick and feel. And so I went to about three services and then came back to my own church and began to change all of the signs in my church to have both Spanish and English, to change all of the announcements on my telephone systems to reflect diversity, to integrate our staff in our leadership until we had people sitting up front who looked like the people who I wanted to come in the service, to incorporate bilingual prayers in our worship service, so that Spanish-speaking people and Caucasian people would come in and recognize diversity. It was a bit of a culture shock to a largely African-American church to have a white guy up there with a guitar singing country western music. And I began to learn that all of us are territorial about certain things that are near and dear to us, and we don't give them away easily. I also began to learn that if there is going to be a sense of brotherhood, which I think is critical, because, frankly, I think America is dealing with an old, antiquated problem while we face contemporary challenges, with terrorism, and yet we're still cleaning up the aftermath of slavery and other issues. We have got to expedite this process so that we can get on with the issues of dealing with the contemporary challenges that we face today. We are lagging far behind. The church is even further behind than that. Also want to comment on, I had the privilege of being in a quorum of diverse religious leaders who were with the president after 9/11. And it was extremely diverse. I mean, just every stream and stripe imaginable. And when he walked out of the room, he was going to declare a war on terrorism before Congress. And it was striking to me to see how differently the demographics in Congress looked from the demographics in the room. My point is simply stated, some of our ideas about inclusiveness and leadership are antiquated based on regions and territories. Maybe we should discuss cultures and colors and getting diversity in the leadership of our government. I also want to suggest to you from a top-level understanding that we must intentionally go after diversity. This melting doesn't just of this great nation doesn't just happen because it's hot. We have to work intentionally to make this melting process, and in order to do that, then all people on all sides have to give up a little bit of turf in order to make this happen. So all of a sudden, we ended up with services that had Eastern Indian people who we invited to do dances as a part of our worship service, and initially African Americans looked at me like, you know, you're drinking. You know, you're on crack. Let's get him some help and therapy. Gradually, we begin to develop an appreciation for each other because we were forced into an environment where we touch and feel and begin to understand each other. In little rooms like this, as we begin to talk about marriages and families and crisis, we found out that our challenges were very similar, and we begin to assimilate and amass together. The other small contribution that I might be able to add to what I think has been a very elaborate and comprehensive presentation is on the political frontier. The religious frontier is bleak because we have not resolved this issue. That does not just affect religious people. It also affects secular people who, whether they know it or not, are affected by religious ideologies as to what is moral and what is right. And most changes that have ever occurred in this country have disseminated from pulpits, not just black ones, but all kinds of ones, where we begin to redefine what is right and what is wrong. If it doesn't happen in your religious institutions, it slows down or retards the process of happening outside the institution. As having hammered that in as well as I can in the brief time I have to share, the other problem that stops politics, in my opinion, from being effective is that we have a disproportionate amount of people of color who are incarcerated in this country. The problem with that, the judicial system is so flawed and so skewed that it is dangerous either because of your ethnicity or your economic dexterity. When you are arrested and you do not have the financial wherewithal to get the kind of representation to get out of prison as readily, money does make a difference when you go to trial. If you don't believe that, ask Michael Jackson, O.J. Simpson, it does matter. In the midst of all of that, we have a disproportionate amount of people of color, both Spanish-speaking and African-Americans, that are incarcerated. What is damning to that as it relates to politics is the way we are set up now is once you have been incarcerated, you lose the right to vote. As long as you lose the right to vote, then politicians are not truly motivated to be as sensitive as they ought to be to your issues because they do not count your vote as a consideration. Until we fix these and many other issues, we're going to have real problems. It's not just how many are in your country, it's how many can vote. And so we have lost our voice. We've lost the voice of economy. We've lost the voice of education. We're losing the voice of voting. And so we can have all the anger we want to, but we're left out of effective change because the things that bring about change in this country are even more demoralizing amongst minorities, not just because of the color of their skin, but by the virtue of the predicament that they find themselves in. I think that until we fix the educational system, which again must be intentional, must be forced, must be effective, must be comprehensive, we will not begin to retard the problems that exist. We will not be able to manage the anger that erupts in young African-American males and Hispanic males who are angry at the system, who are angry at their wives and women who are going ahead of them until the family begins to deteriorate and the self-esteem of black males has reached an all-time low. And we see the perpetuation of black-on-black crime to the point that it is alarming. It is self-hatred because they're trapped in a situation that I think education would really do a lot to help. Economics, the building of wealth, is a critical issue, and the primary thing in the building of wealth is home ownership. 47% of African Americans own their own home, as opposed to 74% of Caucasians. It is so startling that even the lending institutions are now beginning to wonder how they can target minorities because they have saturated the Caucasian market. Though that is not the motivation that I would like to see them have, nonetheless, it still focuses on an issue that we really do need to do something to begin to teach people about the gathering and the garnering of wealth. African Americans still tend to be the nation's largest consumers and poorest investors. And so we really need to work very hard to change that, where we have economics and we begin to not only increase economics, but increase education on how to get the most out of the economics that we have. Some very practical things about investments and about entrepreneurship are going to be critical to the well-being of the future of us coming together. I read an interesting article in USA Today that suggested that over the next 4 years, I think it was $200 million was coming into the African American economy, 200 million, maybe 300 amongst Hispanics. And the article was about Hollywood trying to develop a way that they could target those dollars as it relates to entertainment industry. What we really need is to train those persons how to invest and handle those dollars so that they can be self-sustaining. There are not sufficient efforts being expended in that regard to make sure that we are educating people, not just the lofty philosophical education pursuits, but also the very practical, pragmatic, simple courses, because midlifers are not always going back to school now, that will simply train them what to do with what you have. At the end of the day, I really do believe that we can make a difference in bringing people together. I think that things like this bring us together. There's a great deal of work that can be done. I certainly want to be a part of it. I have benefited from what our predecessors have discussed today, and that is my new contribution to the conversation. Thank you very much. I'm probably the guy who needs the mic the least, and they've given me one. Oh, okay.
Possibilities to raise the black male population up. I'm just wondering if you have any ideas what might be more effective to be able to get them through that process so that they can graduate and move on. And
there are a lot of problems. First of all, and if I open this up, and I have so much passion about it, I think that one of the things that black males are suffering from is the lack of role models in the home. The absentee father issue is unbelievable. It's not just that it exists, but the damage that it does to the well-being of the African-American male is significant and comprehensive. We may not be able to fix that in every case. Homes and marriages are deteriorating at an alarming rate, and it continues to get worse amongst all people, but particularly people of color, it's getting worse. But one of the things that we can do amongst affluent middle class or even educated African-American men, they need, little boys need to see black men who are well-spoken and articulate who look like them. because without those role models in the system, they do not feed themselves in that role. So they aspire more to hip hop or something else that looks successful than they do, because we do not see enough role models. It's not that they are not there, but we are the first or second generation of middle class, affluent or educated African Americans. And quite frankly, we haven't unpacked our furniture as we moved into these new communities. Mm-hmm. So we're still trying to get our footing ourselves, and yet the challenge and the guilt that exists amongst middle-class African-Americans is amazing, because you're told to give back at a time that you haven't unpacked, yet we must find a way to do unpack with one hand, assimilate into our situation, while still giving back leadership and mentoring on the other hand, and I think that is a critical combination that we have to work toward to get it done. The other thing I want to just quickly mention is if we can find a way, and I mentioned this in my little talk yesterday, to market education in such a way that it is cool to be smart, it would change things. And I think that Hollywood and television could be a huge conduit, as well as music, to challenge young people where it is really cool to be smart. If we can just stop glamorizing athletes only, rappers only, and include academians in that glamorization until little boys in our neighborhood want to be one. But right now, they don't always want to be smart, because they are taught that if you are articulate, you talk white. And we need to change that until they see success in their color.
Let me just add that I'm all for glamorous academics. I think that's – but two things. One is that there's a recent study by Steve Raphael from the University of California. Among black high school dropouts in their late 20s, more are in prison on a given day than are working. And this is just a complete serious crisis, and this issue of reentry, not just in terms of voting but in terms of being able to secure employment, is an incredibly important issue. The second thing I would just comment on with what the bishop said is that it was a good description of people who've just gotten through and they're just unpacking, is that a lot of us who came through in a kind of first-generation way don't realize the importance of role models, because they weren't there necessarily for us, and we had to have something inside of us which drove us to achieve without seeing those people, so that I think some folks of my age and older don't fully understand the importance you're saying of role models, because we had to kind of struggle against everything that was there in our way and visualize ourselves in those positions without the role models. When you talk to young people, as obviously the bishop does and I do as a university professor, you begin to really realize how important and powerful that is.
Let me just add one other thing before you leave that. If you look at successes, and we've done that, there are a number of phenomenal successes in terms of schools. There's a superintendent in New York that has black and Latinos in the baccalaureate program performing on parity with whites and outperforming the rest of New York State. If you look at North Carolina, they just changed their school system, and the change within 5 years had blacks, male and female, their performance double and Latinos triple. Minneapolis. I mean, these are all sort of small programs, and I certainly think the role model is part of it. We don't take these programs and take them to scale. The last thing I'll say on role models is I completely agree on role models, but also I think whites need role models of blacks. Whites need role models of Latinos. I mean, most black college professors or women college professors run into a problem of showing up in front of a college class and the student saying, "What are you doing there?" Because they haven't had any role models. They haven't had experience in their own lives of high-performing blacks and women and Latinos. Last thing on this, we had our first woman president of Ohio State University, Karen Holbrook, and I think she's done a phenomenal job. She's basically been run out of town. And the assumption is, how can a woman run a school, a Big Ten school? So the role model thing has to be extended beyond, across just racial boundaries, so all people sort of, you know, are comfortable with people in different roles.
Yeah, two question points. The first one is that I think there was this notion that the macro inequities, once the macro inequities fell, help on a female, help on a black, you know, the kind of macro legal construct, that the pipeline would take care of itself, right? They get in, and then up they go. You know, that, I think that was sort of a major assumption, that was once the intake was there. Well, it turns out that that's not true, that the intake actually is occurring in many places, not completely, but it is occurring in many organizations. It's an upgrade problem. And that Stephen Young is now pointing out that that's not macro inequities, that's micro inequities. It's the subtle, small things that accumulate over time that suddenly disadvantage certain groups and suddenly advantage other groups. Usually the historically in-power group gets suddenly advantaged, the historically out-of-power groups get suddenly disadvantaged. You know, it's who goes to lunch with the boss, who gets the stretch assignment, who gets the critical feedback. All the small things, you start out together pretty equally, but then over time, it's like you getting 4% interest and someone else getting 4.1% interest 20 years later, you've got a substantial difference in money. And so one of the questions is, how do you attack the micro inequity? Because a lot of it is also individual. I don't really want to say anything about this small thing. You know, oh, I don't want to say anything about this small thing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, but it accumulates over time. Much more difficult, much more webbed-in problem. So that the pipeline's got lots of leaks in it. The other question and challenge is a new study called the Hidden Brain Drain. I don't know if any of you have read that. The studies on that, Harvard Business Review has been publishing them. And one of them is about minorities in corporations and the sort of the underutilization, if you will. And some of the examples they give are, like they gave an example of a Hispanic man who had gone to the White House the week before to get an award for working in his community on something. But he didn't want to tell the corporation because it was too stigmatized. It was like drug rehab for things that he was working on. Then there was another one, a man who had completely done a strategic plan for his AME church and didn't want to say anything about that. And then another woman who is taking care of differing generations, African-American woman who's taking care of, and the health plan didn't, you know, put into it, and she didn't want to say anything about that. You know, yet the dominant group is perfectly happy to talk about their opera board and all of those kinds of things, which are leadership development, but so are all these other things, very important leadership development skill sets, but they're not being brought forward for the variety of reasons. How do we overcome that kind of thing, too? Because that also affects kind of the role modeling that you're talking about.
Well, I'll jump in, and then you all could bail me out. One of the things that I think is starting to happen in the private sector is the need to market to people who look differently from the executive. It's forcing him to incorporate new people into the leadership process. Now more than ever, I own a small marketing firm that does niche marketing on the side. And we're getting calls from Hollywood and different places because Hollywood is starting to understand that their cookie cutter style of marketing has exasperated all of the mainstream venues. And now they need desperately to be able to target special interest groups, whether they be minorities or the faith community or what have you. And they do not have a machine to do that, nor do they have any understanding. Helping them to be aware of these changing demographics is going to force them to have to, I think, create an upwardly mobile environment for new people because they are out of touch. In other words, when people begin to know what they don't know, it is very, very helpful. Right now, they think they really know. So the more that we can get in their magazines and things that they read, information that says, hey, if you're going to continue to make profit or do business or do this or that or the other, you have to incorporate. I think that we will begin to, in some ways, break through some of that glass ceiling you're talking about.
Let me comment also just a couple of things. One, Bishop Jake talked about being intentional. There are a lot of things written about what you just referred to. Some of them call it contact versus contract. I think we exaggerate the macro. And we didn't expect, we got what we expected in a sense. And just think about it for a minute. The heart of the civil rights movement started at the end of World War II. And we had a very ambivalent federal government, a very ambivalent state government. They put some things in place to initially integrate blacks and then later Latinos into these structures of opportunity, oftentimes in urbanized areas. What else was going on at that same time? Rapid suburbanization. So if you think about, and I'm from Detroit, if you think about what was happening, the federal government paid for new houses, new subdivision, new roads, new infrastructure, $11 trillion to get whites out of the central city and two new opportunity centers at the same time that it was bringing blacks and Latinos into declining opportunity centers. That's a macro. So the resegregation of America, especially in the Northeast, it's not simply what happens at the cooler. The most success we've had in civil rights in this country primarily has been in the South. We have not had a Northern civil rights movement. The civil rights movement effectively came to an end when Dr. Martin Luther King marched in Skokie and tried to integrate the housing in Skokie and outside of Chicago. All the support for the civil rights movement ended. The most segregated schools, mm-hmm. the most segregated neighborhoods are all in the Northeast. So, you know, while we should celebrate some stuff, the structural changes were huge. And we have never spent that kind of money, that kind of intention to bring society together that we did to pull them apart, to structurally pull them apart. The suburbs, until fairly recently, was, and the money that was loaned to build it, the sprawl, was a white phenomenon. And so, yes, we should do the contact things and the micro things, but we haven't done the macro things, especially in the Northeast.
Just this is available for many of you on your seats, and there's copies of it up here, Edging Toward Equity, and it's a new report came out of the press just 2 days ago, which talks about exactly these issues of suburbanization, but it also makes one other point that relates directly to something Bishop Jakes was saying. There's an emerging body of research which shows that those regions in the United States that are more unequal, in fact, have lower levels of economic performance, and that those regions that are more that are less racially segregated and therefore kind of build teams and take advantage of everyone's talent, in fact, do better. And that is the positive business message that we need to get out there. I think it has to be driven by moral force. And I think this morning someone said, gosh, Bishop Jakes is going to join you. How do you feel about having a preacher on the panel? I said, we're all preachers here.
Right.
Because we're all morally committed and have a moral and spiritual vision about the kind of America that we want. But there's a business case for this, too, that we need to make. One specific thing about your question is to, I guess it's two. One is to realize that one of the reasons why people in those situations don't call on what might be prejudice is they're scared of making a false accusation and fear that they'll be seen only through their race and that maybe there really is a legitimate reason where they didn't get that 0.1%, right? And there's questions that go on. And I think it raises for me is what I like to think about is what do you do when the other is not there, right? In groups of Latinos, if I hear someone say something that I think is derogatory to African Americans, I call them on it, right? If we are in a group of people who are all straight and somebody says something that I view as homophobic, do we call them on it, right? Do we lift up these issues and call people on it when the other is not there? And that's a way of protecting people who are moving through these because it's not just their responsibility to say, I think I didn't get the 0.1. But it's the responsibility of a larger organization to call people on what's going on.
Yeah, just a quick question. In Richmond, we're going to have the opportunity to host a community conversation around the topic of democracy and inclusion in conjunction with the 400th anniversary of the landing at Jamestown. I am curious, and I'm part of that host and planning committee, so I am curious as to who you think we need to make sure is at the table for the conversation, the types of people, and what are the big questions that you think would be very powerful for the group to discuss.
Okay, a little free consulting.
Is that tough?
I think the kind of discussion we had, I think, helps. I think that the thing that Manuel just made reference to help. I think having a community vision, the kind of community they want to be, and then the fight today, and this is in one of the articles that I gave you, the fight today is largely about institutional arrangements. Which seem like they're not about race at all, right? So, for example, funding schools, school zones, low-income housing, in my mind, so sort of looking at these things are sort of like background. We don't even have to think about them. They're just, and then we just say, well, people chose to live in that poor community. It's sort of interesting data. Low-income blacks in particular, when people do attitudes and preference for where people want to live, they usually talk to middle-class African-Americans. And some of them will say, you know, I want to live around other African-Americans. That's reasonable. Yes, low-income African-Americans, that's not what they say. The number one thing for them is to live in a safe community. The racial composition of the community is number, I think, 8 out of the 11 possibilities. They want to live where their kids can go to school, where it's safe. But they don't get to make those choices because we decide collectively where we're going to build low-income housing. We decide where this federal money. So part of it is sort of looking at not just the personal, which I think is extremely important, but look at how we are using these institutions to sort people. And are they serving us? Are they building the kind of equity community that Emmanuel is talking about? And if not, how to change that? How to be intentional? If we want a certain outcome, whether it's on Sunday morning, we want churches to be integrated, or we want schools to be integrated. 83% of Americans say they prefer integrated schools. 83% of Americans don't send their kids to integrated schools. They're not structured in that way. How do we make the institutions do the work for us? So I think really having a very clear vision and being able to talk about the scary part of it. You know, it's like, well, I would like my kid to go to integrated school, but. And what comes after the but is always the most important part of the sentence. You know, I'm afraid they're going to get robbed. I'm afraid they won't get a good education. They won't get into elite schools. You know, all, and we have to deal with all those things and take away the but.
One of the things I'd like to add as you begin your discussion, we bought 400 acres of land adjacent to our church and decided that we were going to build 1,500 homes on it. When we went down to the city, the immediate assumption is that it was going to be low-income housing. Okay, I mean, just with the skin color comes the inference, oh, you're going to build low-income housing. I said, no, we're going to build a mixed community because we don't want to be defined that way as low-income, and we want to for somebody who can only afford a low-income home to live in a neighborhood with middle-class people of different ethnicities and races, because I find as a parent that when my children interact with people who are upwardly mobile, they become much more upwardly mobile. It is very difficult to do the heavy lifting by yourself. There are some sociological issues that are very detrimental to children. And so I'm saying to you that is a conversation that we need to have as minorities. Have we allowed ourselves to be typecast in a role from which we cannot depart? Not only in the system's thinking, but in our own thinking, we tend to speak of ourselves as being low-income people, and we tend to think and speak of ourselves as being stuck in a rut. And not only is the system working against us, but we have to redefine ourselves. I think one of the most dangerous things a company, an entity, a church, a person, or whatever can do is allow other people to define who you are. And so the responsibility becomes ours to redefine ourselves and not to allow a few people to define us based on political agenda or the agenda of the people who cry the loudest for us generally do not represent us. And the people who have the intellectual properties and the vision to really have a comprehensive view of who we are never get the mic. And as we do that, it changes how we see ourselves and it changes how the world sees us.
I got to say just one thing. That's the 400th anniversary of the arrival of immigrants without papers to the United States. And it's definitely something I celebrate. And I don't know how you talk about American democracy and inclusion right now without considering this tremendous immigrant mobilization. It parallels with the civil rights movement in ways that people don't understand. I think they think about a lot of things about borrowing the language, but it's a movement of people who cannot vote, who are seeking the right to have voice in the society. And it's a movement which is a mobilization which trying to have a direct contact on policy and in a fairly moderate way. I mean, many of those immigrants support the sort of compromise that was crafted by McCain and Kennedy. And so I would urge all of us to see a lot of hope in that movement and also to think about that as part of the discussion around democracy and inclusion.
And we have a growing Latino population. So.
We're everywhere.
I just want to know, I want to ask our speakers if they'll stay for a few more minutes to entertain some more questions, but it is the end of our time, so for those of you who have to go, we understand that. But I know this has been just a great conversation, and I know there's a lot of people who haven't had a chance to ask a question yet. So if you don't mind, can we entertain a couple more questions? Do you have to get you have to go.
I apologize.
Okay. Well, thank you so
I
much for joining
the conversation.
Us.
Thank you.
We have a coalition that's doing stuff around anniversary of Katrina. I'd like to be in touch with you about that. Okay.
And the others in this day?
Yes.
All right.